Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Bernice Lerner, author of All the Horrors of War, A Jewish Girl, A British Doctor, and The Liberation of Bergen-Belsen. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, my friends. As this extended spring of our pandemic discontent continues to work its way towards what promises to be a peculiar summer, well, it's a most unusual time for all of us. While some businesses are beginning to open up around the country, it remains unclear what the path forward will yield, or just how dangerous it'll be to, say, go to dinner at a restaurant. I've noticed, who could miss it, that people are beginning to lose patience at being forced to stay home with their families and to struggle against any restrictions on personal behavior, such as wearing masks in public or maintaining social distancing. While medical and scientific professionals continue to urge significant safety precautions be maintained by everyone and warn of coming surges in illnesses and deaths, lots of otherwise responsible people are chafing at continuing to show restraint. There's a certain mentality in most of us that urges us to say we've been fine so far. We don't personally know anybody who's died of COVID-19. The heck with continuing to stay locked down. We want to go out and resume life. And of course, the economic costs of the pandemic and the ways we've curtailed our typical ways of spending money or making a living are hitting home harder and harder. If we do open things up and stop restricting our behavior, won't the economy come roaring back to life? Won't everything be normal? It's reasonable to ask these questions and to struggle against the restrictions placed on our daily lives. Nobody wants to die miserably and alone from COVID-19. But lots of people don't really believe they'll catch the virus, or they think they aren't likely to get sick from it, or at least not very sick, even if they are in a high-risk group. And with the cacophony of voices opining on things in the media, social and otherwise, an increasing number of people are having a hard time believing what anyone in authority says, regardless of how qualified they are or how sensible they're being. And so when we go to a supermarket and see employees wearing masks but leaving them around their chins, rendering them useless, as I saw the other day at a Safeway, and when an increasing number of customers are not wearing masks at all, we do understand what is going on. Reasonable people are getting lazy about restrictions they no longer feel are totally necessary, and they are beginning to act irresponsibly. I'm not talking here about the idiots who have publicly protested, sometimes violently, against the legal restrictions placed upon behavior, restrictions that prevent them from endangering other people's lives. There is no possible justification for the criminals who attack and sometimes kill security guards doing their job enforcing masking requirements, or the jerks who beat up grocery store employees, or the maniacs who insist on carrying Confederate battle flags and AR-15s into state capitol buildings, or rocket launchers into ice cream parlors. These are the 5% of any society who are certifiably insane or criminal or both. Look, there are always crazy people in every civilization in the world, and part of the job of sane, responsible governments and societies is to keep them under control and, if necessary, under lock and key. 6% of Americans don't believe we landed on the moon, for example. I'm also not talking about the USA Today poll last week that found that 32% of all Americans apparently think that a cure for COVID-19 already exists and is being hidden from the U.S. public for nefarious reasons. That number is somewhat terrifying. Nearly one-third of all Americans believe we have a cure and someone, perhaps the deep state or Barack Obama's secret minions, are hiding it Seriously? As P.T. Barnum famously said, no one ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. I suppose it's possible that a third of all Americans believe Elvis is still alive, or that aliens landed in New Mexico and the government is hiding that fact from us. Still, that's a lot of loose screws floating around out there. In any case, back to those of us who prefer sanity to conspiracy and who are not trying to drink bleach to prevent COVID-19. Even as we are having a bit of a hard time by now, after 2 months of lockdown and decreasing human contact, look, when you have this much time to sit at home and read or follow the strange and often depressing news or binge watch TV series and old movies, you can get frustrated and begin to chafe against the limitations. But then, you also have time for much more productive pursuits. For example, you can use this time to think about just what your own belief system's really all about, or how you are choosing to live your personal life. If you are Jewish, it's a splendid time to evaluate how you are experiencing your own version of Judaism. It may be a frustrating period, but it's also an opportunity to explore how you choose to live your own Jewish life. During this period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Passover and Shavuot, I've been engaged in two things I've never done regularly, or quite so regularly anyway, before. The first, which I've talked about here on Too Jewish, is the daily ritual of counting the Omer, not just when I remember to do it, but every day. That means taking a couple of minutes a day, at least, to note the passing of time, from Pesach, the Festival of Freedom, to Shavuot, the Holiday of Covenant. It's a way to connect to God, to appreciate the natural world we've been given, to pray for a moment or two and see that the passing of time, day by day, can have meaning and purpose, even in isolation. The second unique experience I've been having has been leading a Musar study group engaged in exploring an area of Jewish study of our own personal qualities, our soul traits that form our character, and the way that we conduct ourselves in this world. Musar has become a popular field for people in the progressive Jewish world over the last, 10 years or so. Our Musar group is a remarkable experience, a safe place to explore strengths and weaknesses in areas like generosity, kindness, patience, faith, courage, compassion, and so on. We read a text that explains the individual trait we're working on that week, and then look at other texts about it, both Jewish and not, that reflect its meaning and purpose. And then we discuss these texts and our own tendencies and beliefs in each area, and what helps us achieve better success in these qualities, and of course, what blocks us from doing so. The group of people engaged in this are quite wonderful, self-reflective, honest, funny, generous, knowledgeable, and kind. As we have had to move the Musar group, like all synagogue classes, to Zoom, all but two people have managed to make the transition and stay deeply engaged. It's been inspirational to share this work with such a wonderful group, to be able to open up about what challenges us and helps us become better people, or can anyway. That combination of factors, the Musar group and the simple counting of the Omer, have helped keep me sane and, I hope, centered during this challenging time. Perhaps such Jewish engagement might do the same for you. To play us in this morning, here's a classic Yemenite song from Ofra Chaza called Rachamim.
וכולם פורסים לי רשת, וכולם רוצים רוצים, אך אני רק מבקשת רחמים. רחמים, רחמים, הסתכל בעין, שים ואולי תשים גם לב, איך בקרם תן לבנב, שושנה בין החופים, בשבילך ירחמים, בשבילך ירחמים. שורקים לי בחלון, אני איני שומעת, אצלי הלב כמו טלפון שבלשכת השר.
מתי הולכות אליך אוי רחמים מתי תפרוס עליי את רחמך אז נצא לרחוב ביחד מבוכים כזוג יונים ואני כולי זורחת רחמים תסתכל בעין עושים ואולי תשים גם לב איך בקרב
That was the late, great Ofra Chaza singing Rachamim. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, Bernice Lerner, author of All the Horrors of War, A Jewish Girl, A British Doctor, and the Liberation of Bergen-Belsen, will tell us how she came up with the idea of combining two diverse histories from that liberation and creating a fascinating new nonfiction narrative. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. New progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Our synagogue location is 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsoros, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson, and we will be holding services with full music by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access that by emailing us at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogue location is 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall. We're not in the mall, but in our own building. For now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook and our website. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org to get more information or to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school program, rich array of adult education academy courses, and to join, come to beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in all of southern Arizona and the fastest growing synagogue in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Bernice Lerner, who's the daughter of Holocaust survivor Rachel Gnuth, is a senior scholar at Boston University's Center for Character and Social Responsibility. She's the author of previous books about the Holocaust, and her new book, All the Horrors of War, a quote from one of the protagonists of this nonfiction book. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Cohen.
Tell me, where did the idea of
comparing the stories of a liberator and a survivor come from? Where did you get the idea to do that?
It evolved over time. At first, I was only going to write about the liberator. I became interested. I discovered this compelling figure that the world didn't know about, or not many people knew about, and I was going to lift him into bold relief and tell this Oscar Schindler-type figure story. And then as I was working on it, people were asking a lot about my mother, and then I had the idea, well, what if I wrote a dual biography talking about this victim and this liberator who converged in this hell at the end of World War II.
So they never met, correct?
No, they never met. Would have been a more romantic story had they met, but everything is in the book is true as much as I could do the research to verify it. And the situation was such that there were 60,000 people in the camp at the end of the war when Glenn Hughes came upon it, and he did get to know many of the survivors, but not people like my mother, who were so sick and were hospitalized. He mostly befriended and kept in touch with those survivors who were strong young people who emerged as leaders of the displaced persons camp at the end of the war.
Your mom's story is fascinating in its own right. I mean, she really survived, as he put it, all the horrors of war. Now, that came from his testimony when describing the conditions that he found. He was a medical, I'm going to say he was a doctor, of course, but he was a medical authority in the course of the war. When did he arrive at Bergen-Belsen?
He arrived on April 15th, 1945, 1 month after my mother, who was languishing in a hut and really starved and diseased, like almost everybody else there. And it was 3 weeks before the war's end, which was May 8th. It was very unusual. It was an unprecedented situation. Bergen-Belsen was the only concentration camp that was actually handed over by the Germans to the Allies.
We will hear more about that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish with Bernice Lerner describing her book, All the Horrors of War.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetcher or Kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week, we started talking about how Hasidic communities and other ultra-Orthodox groups, not modern Orthodox, have had a higher rate of coronavirus infection and possibly mortality because of the close-knit qualities of those communities, the fact that they have larger families, that they connect to more people automatically, and that even in spite of restrictions, governmental restrictions on assembly, quarantine, and so on, they often get together because not only do they daven three times a day, but there's also siyums because they finish things, and there's celebration seems like every week, some Rebbe's birthday or something.
Passover, Seder, Lag BaOmer, whatever.
Yeah, there's always a holiday, and some of them, and the people have assembled in spite of rules against it. There's a big story about that recently where a Satmar Rebbe's funeral drew many people in New York. New York's been the epicenter of coronavirus infection for a while. Many deaths, terrible situation. And they assembled in spite of the rules about it.
So, I mean, I think that's an example of the truth of the old adage that old habits die hard. We know scientifically that people should leave their doors and windows open and let fresh air flow in, because that helps to kill the virus or minimize the concentrations of the virus. And yet, out of habit, these people meet in closed rooms in stuffy spaces with no ventilation. They don't do anything outside. And even when they're inside, look, you could have a a door open right now.
I could.
You don't.
It's true. No.
So,
true.
I mean, really, old habits die hard.
It's probably 107 degrees.
We don't think through everything.
Right.
So I think that one of the issues is that Hasidim revere their rebbes, and when somebody who's highly regarded as being a very distinguished scholar and leader dies, maybe normally in years past, 20,000 people would have turned out for this funeral.
Right.
In this particular case, it just happened, 5,000 plus people gathered.
So a quarter of what might have been otherwise, but still.
Or a fifth. But it doesn't matter, because the mayor of New York got very upset, went personally to make sure that police dispersed this group that was violating all kinds of things, and announced, as he put it, not only to the Jewish community, but to all communities, I am going to instruct the New York Police Department to issue summonses and ultimately fines to people who violate the rule about gathering in a group bigger than 5 or 10, whatever it is. I don't know. Every city has a different rule.
Yeah,
slightly.
I think it's 10 in New York, but
doesn't
I could
matter.
Be wrong. Yep.
Whatever it is. I mean, 5,000 is clearly unacceptable.
Clearly.
And, I mean, the interesting thing is that the Jewish community in New York and the World Jewish Congress and a bunch of other Jewish organizations reacted to this as if it were a declaration of war against the Jews. And, you know, de Blasio's first announcement didn't even mention Jews. And the second announcement said, I want the Jewish community and all communities to understand this. He wasn't picking on Hasidim. He wasn't picking on ultra-Orthodox Jews. He wasn't even picking on the Jews. But the Jewish kind of knee-jerk response to any statement like this is
anti-Semitism.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it was at all. I agree with you. Look, this is such a terrible and unique situation, and has been now for months, that I think, and also I think there's a level of frustration that just rises the longer you're locked into a
and
small
space. And
fear
and irrationality and mystical thinking, all kinds of nonsense that wouldn't stand up to scrutiny in a normal time.
No. And it affects people's health, unfortunately.
Right.
And that's really the grave danger. And after all, look, that's the highest Jewish value, kuach nefesh, like protecting life.
Right.
It sets aside everything. And in Israel, they've understood this, I think, from the very beginning.
Right.
Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. You're in great shape, says the doctor. You're going to live to be 70. But I am 70, Izzy replies. No, says the doctor. Did I lie? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well till at least 70. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, which is given its English name by the census that occupies a good part of the start of the Torah portion. The Hebrew name for this portion and book, Bamidbar, means in the wilderness. While the name comes from the first words of the book, it has a greater resonance and meaning than simply lexicographical location. It also speaks of place in a different and powerful way. Every time we Jews seek inspiration, it seems, we must head out into the desert. It was true of Abraham and Jacob. It's certainly true of Moses. And after the Exodus, it's true for the whole people of Israel who wander for 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar Sinai, seeking God and revelation. Why do we have to head out into nothingness in order to find truth? Perhaps it's simply because our own lives are so filled with complication and complexity, which seem critical during our daily grind, but most of the time turn out to be truly unimportant. But until we leave behind the convenience of home, until we divest ourselves of comfort and conceit, we are unable to really understand what truly matters. Faith blooms freely in the desert, where there is nothing to prevent a person from seeing the world as it really is, coming to understand God's amazing role in it as creator and maker of covenants. You too can find God in the wilderness, just as true for the Sonoran Desert as it was for the Sinai Desert of our ancestors. We simply need to look for God, away from all the complications of our daily lives. The poet asks, must we enter the desert to hear your voice? And we can answer, yes. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Bernice Lerner, will tell us remarkable stories about an unsung hero of World War II and her own mother's extraordinary tale. Hear those intertwined stories and more when we come back in To Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Coalition talks between Likud and the right-wing Yamina alliance broke down just 2 days before the new government was sworn in, leaving Naftali Bennett eventually out in the cold. The final attempt to bring Yamina into the government came days after the alliance had stated its intention to sit in opposition. Due to the makeup of the government and its likely policy as a left-wing government headed by Netanyahu, we'll see, and in light of the prime minister's outright disdain towards Yamina and its voters, we've decided to serve the public from the opposition, said Yamina. We will prepare for the day after Netanyahu in a year and a half when Kahol V'Lavan, blue and white head Benny Gantz, takes over as prime minister under the coalition agreement. Yamina would have brought an additional 6 Knesset seats to the coalition, which already has a majority. Likud said Netanyahu offered Yamina head Naftali Bennett, currently serving as defense minister, the education ministry and Jerusalem ministry, as well as deputy minister. Bennett reportedly demanded health and transportation ministries and the chairmanship of the Knesset's Law, Constitution, and Justice Committee. He didn't get them. Likud accused Yamina of being greedy in its demands, especially due to its small size as a party these days, and of demanding ministerial portfolios that have nothing to do with religious Zionism, its stated priority. Tonight it became final that Bennett and Yamina have decided to quit the right-wing bloc. Bennett's refusal of our generous offer for Yamina to control all the issues that are important to religious Zionism reveals that he cares about cabinet seats, not ideology, said Likud. Well, perhaps the last drama of this long Israeli election and negotiation soap opera has ended, and the final composition of the government is complete without Naftali Bennett and the far right wing, at least the secular, the right wing included. A week before Bibi Netanyahu's corruption trial is to begin, he will formally be installed as prime minister. In New York, 2 weeks after announcing the cancellation of its summer programs in the U.S. and Israel, the Union for Reform Judaism announced major staff layoffs last week. About 60 full-time employees, constituting 20% of the URJ's staff, was laid off. The organization also implemented a temporary pay reduction between 3% and 16% that began back in April. Rick Jacobs, the president of the Union for Reform Judaism and a past guest of Two Jewish, took a 16% pay cut, as did the rest of his executive team. In an email to staff, board members, and community leaders, Jacobs pinned the layoffs on the coronavirus pandemic, which has induced a sweeping financial crisis. The impact of COVID-19 on all of our revenue streams has been crushing. We anticipate it will take several years to recover, said Jacobs. Consequently, our organization must get smaller. The layoffs will go into effect June 30th. Jacob said the organization will also furlough additional employees. Those furloughs, which employees are not paid and do not work but are expected to return, will last from June 1st to August 31st. The URJ, the Union for Reform Judaism, is the umbrella organization of the Reform movement in North America. It provides program support, leadership development to synagogues, and oversees the movement's summer camps, youth groups, and social justice work. Jerry Stiller, the classically trained actor who became a comedy star twice, in the 1960s in partnership with his wife Ann Mira, and in the 1990s with a memorable recurring role on Seinfeld. Jerry Stiller died last week in his longtime home on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and he was 92 years old. Stiller's accomplishments as an actor were considerable. He appeared on Broadway in Terrence McNally's farce The Ritz back in 1975 and David Rabe's dark drama Hurley Burley in 84. Off-Broadway, he was in the Three Penny Opera. In Central Park, he played Shakespearean clowns for Joe Papp. And on screen, he was a police detective in The Taking of Pelham 123 and Divine's husband in John Waters' Hairspray. But he was best known as a comedian. The team of Stiller and Miro is for many years a familiar presence in nightclubs, on TV, variety and talk shows, in radio and TV commercials, most memorably for Blue Nun Wine and Amalgamated Bank.
How do you do?
How do you do?
I'm Hershey Horowitz.
I'm Mary Elizabeth Doyle.
Doyle?
Horowitz.
Horowitz. H-O-R-O-W-I-T-Z. Hershey. My friends call me Hesh.
Doyle. D-O-Y-L-E. My friends call me Mary Elizabeth.
Is Doyle your real name?
Sure. Why wouldn't it be my real name?
I don't know. I mean, I was just hoping you...
No, we're Doyle. We're Dempsey's on my mother's side.
Dempsey.
Horowitz.
Schmullowitz on my mother's side.
Years after the Stiller and Mira act broke up, Jerry Stiller captured a new generation of fans playing Frank Costanza, the short-tempered and not entirely sane father of Jason Alexander's George Costanza, on the NBC series Seinfeld, one of the most successful TV comedies of all time. Stiller was in just 30 of the 180 episodes of Seinfeld, whose 9 seasons began back in 89. He did not make his first appearance until the 5th season, but he was an essential part of the show's appeal. Jerry Stiller was nominated for an Emmy in 1997.
And at the Festivus dinner, you gather your family around and tell them all the ways they have disappointed you over the past year.
And is there a tree?
No, instead there's a pole. Requires no decoration. I find tinsel distracting.
Frank, this new holiday of yours is scratching me right where I itch.
Let's do it then.
All right.
Festivus is back! I'll get the pole out of the crawl space.
Well, happy Festivus.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Just a few months after the final episode of Seinfeld, in which Frank had a last moment in the spotlight, spending most of it yelling, as he often did, Jerry Stiller was back on TV playing another off-kilter father, a marginally more restrained version of Frank Costanza, on another sitcom, The King of Queens. He was a regular then. He played Arthur Spooner, the excitable father of the wife, Leah Remini, of the working slob central character, Kevin James, for the show's whole 9-season run. Anne Mira was a guest star on several episodes of The King of Queens, and her character married Jerry Stiller's in the series finale. Younger viewers might not have known it, but their scenes together represented the reunion of one of the most successful male-female comedy teams of all time. Stiller and Mira began performing as a duo in New York City nightclubs in 1961 and soon made the first of about 36 appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show. Visually, Mira and Stiller were a study in contrast. She was tall and bright-eyed, he was short and stocky, and always looked a little lost. The biggest contrast that formed the basis for much of their comedy was that her heritage was Irish-American and Roman Catholic, although she converted to Judaism in 1961, before their children were born. His was Eastern European and Jewish, his mother from Poland, his father from Galicia. At a time when it was rare for men and women of different religions to date, let alone marry, Stiller and Mira broke new comic ground with their routines about the rocky but loving relationship of Hershey Horowitz and Mary Elizabeth Doyle, characters loosely based on their own lives. Their son, actor and director Ben Stiller, directed his dad in supporting roles in the films Zoolander and Zoolander 2, and directed both of his parents in a series of online videos about 10 years ago. Anne Mira died in 2015, and now Jerry has joined her, reuniting their team to entertain at the great comedy club that I hope is in heaven. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Bernice Lerner is the author of the book All the Horrors of War, A Jewish Girl, A British Doctor, and Liberation of Bergen-Belsen. She's a senior scholar at Boston University's Center for Character and Social Responsibility, has written 2 previous books about the Holocaust,
and did an enormous amount of research. What did you find so compelling about the figure of Brigadier Hughes?
I think I found compelling about him his empathy for the victim and his the fact that he had this watershed experience after observing some of the people that he saved slowly regaining their personalities and coming back to life. You have to remember that he came to a situation that was indescribable and unprecedented. There were 10,000 unburied corpses. 17,000 had died the month of March alone, and 36,000 people died in Bergen-Belsen the first 4 months of 1945. And he came to this real hell where the Nazis had basically, just by neglect, hadn't fed people, they were starved. It was not the same situation as in Auschwitz, let's say, where there were gas chambers and people were killed immediately upon arrival or soon after, and you didn't see as many skeletal figures. But here in Bergen-Belsen, you saw all these war-ravaged people who had already survived so much and had been dumped in Bergen-Belsen. And he came, he was not prepared. His army was not prepared for this. Their battles were still raging in northwest Germany, and he was handed this responsibility. And what I was taken with was the way he handled it, and he had to handle it even though he was emotionally bereft. He was really crying, breaking down at some points just by seeing the condition that people had been reduced to. And he had this, he was a doctor in between the wars, and he had been a war hero in World War One, and I was, he was just something. He had this watershed experience that summer, and everybody that I spoke with who knew him just talked about the warmth of his character and what a giant he was in terms of his compassion. And I just thought the world had to know about him. He became a real champion of the survivors and by extension the state of Israel, and saw his role in the narrative of the Jewish people, that he saved, and people from the Hitler's scourge became a source of great pride for him in his life, and he carried it with him always. At his funeral, he had one of the rabbis who was at Bergen-Belsen, Rabbi Isaac Levy, say a prayer for the martyrs of Belsen. And he just remained in touch with many of the survivors and visited Israel for every anniversary and came to the United States to any events held by the Bergen-Belsen survivors. And he was just an unusual character. So he was very compelling to me. And of course, as I started to really research his life deeply and try to find out as much as I could about him, I learned all kinds of other things that I couldn't include in the book. It would have just been, there could have been several biographies written of Glenn Hughes because of his many involvements in so many realms of activity, from rugby, football, to golf, to medical care, to the British National Health Service. So, but I focused on his role in saving a remnant of the Jewish people.
When they arrived at Bergen-Belsen, Hughes, who had gone through so much already, did they have any idea what they would find?
No idea. Absolutely no idea. I mean, as they were traveling through Germany, they came across some Stalag POW camps, and they saw people in terrible condition, and they saw some escaped inmates on the road, but they had absolutely no clue. It was shocking. It was horrifying. And they were, every field ambulance and casualty clearance station and all the medical units were very busy with the battles that were raging at that time. And he didn't have personnel to handle the situation. He had to really impress upon the Second Army, the humanitarian mission that was at hand. So they had it was a total shock to them. And it was the only camp that the Germans handed over to the British. And they had told them that there were 1,500 typhus cases, and there were probably 15 times that many. So they really had to scramble for resources.
Tell us your mother's story. I mean, it's very complicated, but tell us, you know, she had been through Auschwitz already. She went through a death march. I mean, her experiences are unbelievable. The fact that she survived is extraordinary.
She was really on the margins at the end of the war. She could very easily have died had the British come in just a few days later. And her story was that she is kind of a compelling character. If I separated out the fact, if I divorced her from being my mother and just looked at this kid, she was sort of very different than Anne Frank. Anne Frank was a little bit older than her, and Anne Frank died probably a week or two in Bergen-Belsen before my mother arrived there. And she just came from a very different background because my mother had grown up very poor. They had no privilege in her life at all. She had kind of hard scrabble childhood, second of six children. Her father had been drafted into Hungarian forced labor. She had big responsibilities at home, had to miss a lot of school. And I think that sort of her struggles as a kid and sort of built her character in some ways. And she was kind of naive, but on the other hand, kind of street smart. And kind of when I heard her story when I was a teenager of how she survived the war, I admired her so much because she was this girl victor over Hitler. She was shy but able to advocate for herself. And so my mother's background is she came from a very religious community in Sziget, Transylvania, in the Carpathian Mountains, a beautiful town.
By the way, I should note that's right. That's Elie Wiesel's hometown, Sziget, also.
Yeah. I visited there last spring, and I couldn't believe her house was like just two blocks away from Elie Wiesel's house. And yeah, so I'm sure their fathers knew each other and they belonged to the same synagogue. So, so she, her story is just she went through all these terrible, terrible ordeals, and miracle, her parents and younger siblings were murdered. Probably, for sure, her mother, likely her father and her brother too, were murdered in Auschwitz. She and her sister miraculously made it out of there. And then the book traces where they were that entire last year of the war. Things happened very rapid fast for the Hungarian Jews. They were not given over to Hitler until the spring of 1944. And at that time, Glenn Hughes was preparing for the invasion of Normandy and how he would evacuate casualties. So the book traces their journeys in the last year of the war, season by season, until they both converge in this place in northwest Germany. But her story is, I think, both of their stories are very compelling, but she was the victim, and it was a race against time.
When Hughes arrived at Bergen-Belsen and, you know, had this unbelievable responsibility, I mean, just burying the dead alone would have been a huge responsibility, but trying to save the lives of tens of thousands of dying people, what was extraordinary about his conduct?
Something that you would never think would be extraordinary, but I was very struck by it, was that he cried. I mean, he really cried in the beginning because he was trying to figure out how he was going to do this with so little manpower, so few resources. And he mobilized very, very fast, and he just called for help immediately from wherever he could think of getting help. And he established the system of triage, and he put people in place, other people who could help him in leadership, someone to be in charge of a hospital, someone to really canvass the area for what resources, what facilities were available. And he just moved on it really quickly, trying to save lives. First thing, getting water and food in immediately. And then from there, how were they going to feed people who had been starved and reduced to animal-like behavior? How were they going to create order? How were they going to how are they going to disinfect people? It's like, you know, a lot of things that are happening today in the world remind me of the medical rescue. Of course, completely different evils and assaults and different situations, but in terms of trying to save lives, just the unpreparedness and scrambling to collect resources from where. And he was just, you know, brilliant in how he organized meetings and gave orders and just, you know, things that are logical, but you know, you don't think of in times of duress, like, oh, you know, we're going to go into every German house in the area and everybody has to submit, you know, give over 2 blankets by tomorrow morning, like from the littlest detail to the masterminding of the whole operation. How are we going to wash people and clean them up and get them to a safe place where they could stand a chance of recovering if with minimal care, because there wasn't enough medical personnel to give personal attention to the inmates. So very few had hands-on care. So he just, I think, you know, we could criticize, but now after the disasters that we see happen, whenever something happens in the news, I always think, like, if they say that the British Army didn't save enough lives, well, it takes time. Rescue takes time. Hurricane Katrina took time. Now it's taking so much time. We don't even the experts don't really have a handle on this coronavirus. And, you know, they're also scrambling to collect resources, and they've also been unprepared when something so shocking happens. And a lot of parallels, even in terms of collecting data, the obsession with numbers. I mean, it's a way in a crisis situation for the organized to try to make sense of the situation and not being able to do it quite accurately then or now. So I think he did the best job he could. And the greatest testimony to that is perhaps the fact that the survivors who worked with him, anyone who had any medical knowledge who worked with him, they named the hospital at Bergen-Belsen the Glenn Hughes Hospital. And they called him later at the first Zionist Congress that was held in the fall. They called him the father of the Jewish survivors of Bergen-Belsen, because they sensed his warmth and compassion and caring.
It's an extraordinary story, and he had an opportunity later in life to be reunited with the so-called the Belseners, the people who had survived. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so there were certain people who came to Bergen-Belsen, like I would say within 10 days or a week before it was liberated. So they were suffering and they were starved, but they were in relatively better shape than people who had been there if they had been able to survive longer. And so from among them, there were some who had been active in Zionist youth groups. They were people in their like 20s and 30s, and they were strong and they were young, and they emerged as leaders in the Bergen-Belsen camp. Josef Rosenstaft and several others, and Glenn Hughes was like observing them, and he saw how they were like organizing a community out of these grieving survivors, and how the young adults of the survivors, having lost so much, were trying to create families and build families. I mean, in the years after the war, 2,000 babies were born in the Glenn Hughes Hospital. It was like the largest baby boom in history, and he was very taken with this. This was a story that was unfolding before his eyes. And so he befriended some of these leaders among the survivors and others, and he kept in touch with them. And when he visited Israel, he got a big reception, and he came to the United States, and he was invited to Passover Seders, and he corresponded with some of them, and he had a reunion for some of them who were helping out with the medical rescue in London with the other doctors who were involved. So he stayed in touch with some of the young Jewish leaders in Bergen-Belsen, and they became his lifelong friends.
I want to thank Bernice Lerner for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is incredibly compelling. All the Horrors of War, A Jewish Girl, A British Doctor, and Liberation of Bergen-Belsen. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
Well, the book is available at any place that sells books, online or local retail stores can get it. And my website is www.bernicelerner.com.
Bernice, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Cohen.
You're very welcome. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Mara B. Gad, author of The Color of Love, a story of a mixed-race Jewish girl. Our playout this morning comes from the Klezmer Group, the Yiddish classic Arum Dem Feier. The group is called Spielberg. This Arum Dem Feier is sort of in honor of what we could not do last week on Lag BaOmer, have a big group hanging out around a bonfire. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Arum Dem Feier, wir singen Lieder. Die Nacht ist teuer, mein Wort mit Miede. Und soll das Feuer verloschen werden, scheint auf der Himmel mit seinen Sternen. Freund ich mit Blumenkranz, warum du mir Feuer mir freilich tanzen, weil Tanz und Lied ist unser Leib, der noch im
Dem Feuer mir singen Lieder, die Nacht ist teuer, mir wird nicht wieder. Soll das Feuer verloschen werden, leicht auf der Himmel mit seinen Sternen. Doch grün die Feier mit Freilich tanzen,
weil Tanz und Lied,
weil Tanz und Lied ist unser Leben. Wer noch in Schloch hallo im Schweben.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.